Hi, George, it's Debbie. How are you?
Good, Debbie. How are you?
Fine. Well, I have to say, number one, I just love your work and everything you guys at Formosa do. I am so thrilled to see you as part of Taylor's world with 1883, Bass Reeves, Landman. It's very exciting to have that consistency. And somebody that
Yeah.
understands the tonal consistency and the sonic changes in the decades. And going from 1883 to 1923 in particular, I love how the sound has changed because of how the world has changed. And we get to hear all of that. But particularly with 1923, because we're not just confined to the ground and Montana. Now we're across the oceans. We're on ships. Cars have been invented. And the world has expanded to include all of that, right down to lion hunting in Africa. Just going the excellence of season one, you have upped the ante with the sound and the sound editing here and the mixing for season two. And it's because the world is now getting even bigger, but also more disparate in the dynamics of our characters. I mean, you're giving us, yes, we have ships crossing the ocean, but we have Alexandra's passenger ship, Spencer's trawler or whatever kind of ship he's on, but more from a working, stoking the fires point of view. Alexandra's is crammed into steerage with the boats rocking and the crashing surf outside and water pouring in. Two totally different sound experiences. We also have the ocean calm. You take us to Galveston with the beach calm. Or Spencer's arrival. You bring in cars. You've got so many different kinds of cars here. We've got Whitfield's fancy car in Montana. We've got New York cabs. We've got what the Texas bootleggers and marshals are driving down in Texas. This is a cacophony of joy, George. How do you even? And trains, we have different kinds of trains that have different sounds, boxcar versus passenger. And then, of course, the must-have stampedes, gallops, clip-clop, clopping, herds, moving through water, gunfires, bow and arrow. Where do you even start in your approach to for
Well, first
1923?
of all, thanks for all those kind words, and I love your energy. I always heard about it, and I'm so glad to be finally part of it now to experience it. So thank you for everything and all that you do. I just wanted to put that out there
Oh, thank you.
before anything. But you nailed it. I mean, you're so poetic saying all of that from 1883 to 1923 and season one to season two, but. It all starts with the mighty pen, honestly, and Taylor and his team, they created all that. And again, you nailed everything precisely. How season one, we saw Ju or Alexandra and her crew, living the high life and then falling in love with Spencer's character. And then season two, Taylor just brought them down a notch. He said, "You're going to work for this." He put them, in the bowels of the ship or with, not first class anymore for Alexandra with the regular folks type of thing, and that was shocking to her. Everything translates to sound. So when when they do such a great job at the beginning from writing and then acting and even the way they film it and the picture editing comes along, it sounds just when all that is done great and correct, sound just sort of melts in like butter. And granted, we had a lot of work to do to make everything. Complement the characters, whether they're going through strife or accomplishing an escape. The heroes, get away one scene after another after every episode. So we did our research. What's this train sound like back in 1923? What did cars sound like? At one point, we had a telephone operating department, which most people never knew existed, depending what your age is. So we had to research that. We spoke to historians. lot of work to research and to edit and to experiment, especially around music. We just do dialogue and sound effects, and the music comes in from Brenton Vivian, the composer, and Kyle Clausen, the music editor. But putting all that together, it really was a joy. I mean, we had such a great time with all the episodes just because it was so well done. But, you know, if it's done right before it gets to sound, sound is just that much more more joyous to be part of. And you have more time to experiment because you're not trying to fix something that just wasn't done properly before, if that makes any sense.
Oh, that makes perfect sense. I'm so tickled that Ben has directed these episodes. I've known Ben Richardson since his early days as a cinematographer, and to see what he has brought and how he has come into Taylor's world and really Taylor just picked him up and took him along on so many things. The visuals are outstanding.
Right.
And as you said, so much of this particular sound for 1923 season 2 is based on the visuals. You know, we get that incredible snowstorm, and we've got to have the wagon turning over, and not just flipped over once, but totally flipped over. And you've got to have the winds, and storm winds in Montana winter, even to this day, are a lot stronger than any other kind of snowstorm winds.
Right.
And we hear that, but still, we hear the clunk of the wagon wheels hitting and the clapboards hitting the ground, hitting the snow. And then when they emerge in the morning to the bright sun, we hear the crunch. And even though it's a softer snow, there's still a crunch there. On the flip side, when we're at the Yellowstone, it's a different kind of snow that's there. Most of what we see, it wasn't as hard as the journey that Jacob was on to bring everybody home. That's a different sound that we get there. And then you get to bring in a coyote and a cougar.
Yes, yeah, that was fun.
And
yeah.
I love the cougar. Number one, we meet the cougar and get the cougar sounds when Jacob is there on the porch with him. But then later on, when the cougar is out there, and we see Frozen, and we see Helen Mirren's, there she is, rifle in hand, but we hear the sound through the window, through the logs. It's more muffled, but we can hear the growl of that cougar. And then, of course, exploding glass. You know, for whatever reason, Taylor really likes to have exploding glass in all of his series. Be it exploding all...
He certainly made Helen a hero in that moment, for sure.
I mean, to Yellowstone itself, and how many times it was breaking glass and shattering on Beth being thrown through it. And then in 1883, when we get some glass is being destroyed. This scene, though, with the cougar and Helen shooting through that, and to be able to hear the glass, the cougar, the screams, the wood framing within the window breaking, that is one of the coolest segments that you did, for my money.
Wow, thank you. Yeah, it actually started with the first scene with Harrison's dialogue. He was basically staring at the cougar and saying, I know you're not here to eat me and I don't want to shoot you. So we purposely played the cougar just growling and moaning, not threatening, because he was just here looking for food, and then he left, that he ran off on the first scene. But then the second scene, apparently he couldn't find food, so he came back, which, you know, prompted Helen Mirren to, you know, bring out the shotgun and everything. And yeah, you are right. We muffled the sound, but we also increased the cougar vocal effects, because now it's not, I'm here looking for food, I'm here to get my food. And if it's going to be you, to Michelle, you know, so be it. But then again, Taylor, you know, perfectly just put the picture together and script together to make Helen the hero, to save Michelle from, you know, 1 second prior that cougar was about to leap. So we built those sounds based off the dialogue, you know, not a threat now, but now I am a threat. So hopefully that came across, and I'm glad you liked it.
Oh, yeah. Of course, what cougar would have the balls to attack Harrison Ford. Who would, in their right mind, would do that? Not man nor animal.
Yeah, it was really well shot, though. The way Harrison stood there calmly, like he's like the seasoned pro. He knows when a threat is a threat and when it's not a threat. I just love the way they edited the picture there and the story point, you know.
But then, of course, poor Michelle. Not only does she have to endure almost being attacked by a cougar, she gets attacked by a coyote.
Yeah, the next episode, right?
This poor woman may never work for Taylor Sheridan again. Here again, the sounds, the chicken coop scene, and the way the music is brought in. And I have to shout out to Brenton and to Brian on the score, because it is different than what everybody knows from Yellowstone, but yet within the motifs in the music, you can hear probably 5 or 6 strains of the actual Yellowstone theme. And this is in the 1883 score as well. So I love that. And the way that you finesse the score into everything, it's much lighter in 1923. The way you have interspersed and edited the score in versus in Yellowstone proper and even 1883. There's a lot more finesse and softness with the score in the 5 episodes that I've seen this season. And I love that.
Yeah, it's definitely a character for sure. I'm glad you're noticing that. We weren't going to just say, bring the faders up, make it loud. And Kyle Klaus, the music editor, he really like sculpted this. They listen to the story and dialogue, and they really do work around it, work with it, work for it. It really is a masterpiece. Especially season 2, I really loved what Brenton and Brian did.
Oh my God, I have loved Brian for many years, and his work. And generally, every year about this time, we're on the phone doing interviews about Yellowstone or something. Same with Brenton. But it is the nuance with this particular season, I have to say, George, and not just with the music, but the nuance bringing all of these sounds together, really, along with the dialogue, is, I think, some of the most superlative sound editing and sound mixing and design of the entire Yellowstone box set, shall we say, from Yellowstone to 1883 to 1923. This season is truly award-worthy and standout. It speaks volumes emotionally. You immerse us in the changing world of the time.
A team effort, and I'm glad you mentioned Ben Richardson earlier. I mean, he directed a movie. This is like a 7-hour movie. I mean, he and working with him, we had his work earlier in the other series, but he was never in post-production. This one, he was, basically running post-production with Michael Friedman together, because it was really his child. He didn't film 7 episodes. He filmed a 7-hour movie, and he just, wanted to put it all together, and he was involved day-to-day throughout the sound process, editing, mixing, ADR, all that stuff. And he was a kid in a candy store, too. I mean, he was so energetic, and you feed off of that. You see them so excited, and you want to do more. You're constantly going above and beyond, just like, what else can we do for you? And, at some point he said, this is what I want. This is exactly what I was looking for. And, we had a good feeling working with him, and I'm glad you said those kind words about him earlier.
Oh, Ben is just, he's so wonderful. He's such a lovely human being. And he is, he's very inquisitive. He wants to up his own game. He wants to up the game of everybody around him. And to watch his journey to where he is now, it's like a wow. A wow.
Right. Yeah, we were excited for sure to see him on the stage. It's, a director, a cinematographer, usually when they're done filming, especially in television, they're on to the next episode or series. But he was there the whole way, every day, and it was really a pleasure to experience that.
I love how you describe this as a 7-hour movie. I've watched all 5 episodes that have aired so far individually when they have aired. But then last night I sat down and I just binged those first 5 since the last 2 haven't aired yet. I just binged them as a movie. No stops. Just watched it. Obviously, no, skip the recap. No, skip the intro. Skip the end credit. I watched it as a movie. And it is riveting. It is a fully sensory and immersive experience watching this. So much is because of the sound. I've been in Grand Central Station before. I know what it sounds like with the echo and the hollowness of the reverberation of an empty station or a station with a bunch of people in it. I detected that and picked that up when Alexandra got there.
That's good.
You hear the footsteps. Footsteps on that floor, just like in the 69th Street Station in Philadelphia. It's a very distinct footstep on that flooring, on that marble, on that tile. And it's those little details that inform us, especially in this transitory time in the United States and in the world. How much of this is production sound? How much do you have in your sound library to bring this to life, George?
Locations you're speaking about, I definitely want to credit Richard Bullock, who was our sound mixer on set. He did both seasons, and he did a great job of capturing the environment when they were filming, because a lot of those locations had hundreds of extras in the background, going through the motion of preparing for their trip, finding the terminal, the gate, et cetera, et cetera. So he captured all of that where he could, and we dug around for, several hours every take, looking to see what we could steal from production just so we can get the real thing. We obviously sweetened it with our own effects, give it a little more life since we're mixing for a theatrical environment, 6-track environment. And there is some library stuff, but we first and foremost we try to keep what's in production because that's what everybody's used to hearing. The actors were feeding off of that energy in the background, whether it was the extras or the sound. So we try to keep some of that, but we do add some elements from recordings that we've had over the years from those exact locations. Obviously not from 1923, but we'll put those in. But first and foremost, it's yeah. Let's try to keep what it sounded like on the day. Just to match the energy of the way they filmed it.
I'm curious, for the telephones and the operator in the marshal's office and elsewhere, those phones, very specific sound, very specific ring, very specific of cords moving, with the connections being made. Were you able to source that, or did you have to craft that from scratch?
We actually found phone rings from the 30s, not quite 1923, and I spoke to a historian, and they informed me that the operators with their little headsets, so I don't want to call them headphones, but they normally, the sound goes through the headset. That's how they hear a call coming in. We took some creative licenses and just added some sounds just to fill up the room. When a phone call comes into the individual office, like the sheriff's office, when they went from one state to the next, that was a specific sound from almost 100 years ago, not quite, but we were lucky to find a sound library that had that collection. So we were excited about that. I always hesitate to recreate something on, information only. On my first instinct is to try to find something close, and we were off about 7 years, but let's hope it didn't change much from 1923 to 1931. Came up with that.
What I also love that you did, and I actually, many, many decades ago, I actually worked here in Los Angeles at for a PBX for a woman that ran a company, and all they handled were talent, industry people, actors, directors, producers. She had a, it was 5 boards with 100 lines on each board, and with the cord and the plug-in, the cord and the plug-in, connecting the lines. So I was tickled to see that in the visuals, because even 40 years ago, looked the same as what Ben gave us on camera visually from 1923. But you could hear the movement of the cloth-covered cable, plugging it in, plugging the connection in. So I was very tickled with the authenticity factor there with the sound and the visual.
Well, tell me, because you just said the cloth-covered cable, because the way Ben shot it is he exposed the coil cables, and in Foley we made sure those cables rattled the wood when they were moving to connect to the show. So you had cloth-covered cables?
There was cloth around them, but you could hear it when it would hit the counter where you're taking messages and things, and when you were hitting the boards with it. So the coil cables, but fiber around it. So it wasn't noisy.
I see. Interesting. That's fascinating, because we really spent a lot of time trying to find the right sound for those cables that they were dragging.
Yeah.
From one connection to the next. And once you said cloth, my ears sprung up a little bit. And I saw a lot of photos from the 50s and 60s. Unfortunately, there was no sound. They just played it with music in the background to explain the way things went. But that's fascinating. I'd love to see a photo. Actually, you're saying about 40 years ago you did that?
I may have some pictures somewhere. I will actually try and find some for you, George.
That's fascinating. But now you're tickling me here. Thanks so much. I would love that. That's fascinating. It is great, actually, I don't know if there's a season 3 for 1923 yet, but researching is always amazing, especially someone my age. I'm in my 50s, and it's just great to learn what happened before us. We've always talked about it, but when you really dig into it for this purpose, it just opens your eyes and ears. So it's just like, wow, what was life like just, 60 years before me?
Yeah. Research has always been one of my favorite things to do. I mean, I love going down the rabbit hole. If I see something on screen, I start digging. If I hear something, a sound or something, I start digging. I love going down the rabbit hole on with doing research, especially on elements like this.
Yeah, that was fun. That was a lot of fun, just to see what it was like. And, look at us. Here I am holding an iPhone speaking to you. You know what I mean? The way we're describing these photos, or the way you described the photos and the research I did, it was just amazing,
Back to 1923 here.
Mm-hmm.
I have to ask, it's one of my favorite parts. It was one of my favorite parts of Yellowstone, favorite parts of 1883 and 1923. Herding those cows, and here we're herding Texas Longhorns.
Right.
Did you get production sound for this? Because we've got the beautiful herding of the strays going over that small little river when our Native Americans are actually helping and pick up some day work from the wonderful rancher played by C. Thomas Howell, unrecognizable.
Right.
But then we also have them, we also have them stampeding through town. Is all of this, is it production sound? Are you pulling it from elsewhere? Because the sound is so spectacular.
Yeah, those are two different locations. The second one with Tiona and her native relatives and our ranchers. There was very little production to use there because of the way it was shot. They couldn't get the microphones in, so we recreated a lot of that, especially when they were crossing the stream or the river.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a lot of recordings. Now, over the years, when I've been working on 1883 or the first season of 1923, anytime I hear good production sound of animals, I actually keep it. I mm-hmm. built a library over two or three seasons across both series, and I'll resort to that and use them. So, but the crossing through the mountains towards the ranch, that was pretty much all recreated through our sound library of hooves, and we also called on our Foley crew to create some sounds just so we could spread out and make it bigger than it make it sound bigger than it looks. The in-town one with our priest Sebastian, that was a lot of production. And if you do watch it again, you'll hear those cowboy whistles and call-outs telling them to move. Those are actually ranchers on the set, and Richard, our sound guy on the set, captured all that. So we kept all that. Just really, I mean, they were trying to just tame him and steer them in the right direction, but it just fit in perfectly as this is what they would do, as opposed to them being the set workers just helping with the filming of the herd going through town. So we still added some library sounds to that and some Foley sounds that we designed and created, but there was more production from that location as opposed to the second location. They both look beautiful, really well shot, and I love the music on the second one when they were crossing the river, going up and down the valley and the trails and everything. So it came across pretty good, I thought. Both of them had a nice difference, just enough to say, going through town, hurry, hurry, because there's cars and there's people trying to cross, as opposed to when we got to the second one, the music was just like, look, everybody's getting along, nobody's in trouble, before the finale of the episode when Tiona sees her wanted picture on one of the stalls, and all of a sudden everything shifts. So we, you know, we purposely didn't play that much herd sounds and let the music take over, just to really bring out the beauty of the way Ben shot it. And then obviously we wanted, you know, such beautiful sound before the, you know, worrisome shot of Tiona. All of a sudden, you know, she's not safe anymore. Whereas earlier, the beginning of the episode, when they were coming through town, that's when we really played up the rumble of the herd and the close-up. Even Ben shot it that way. There wasn't that many wide shots. He just, like, stuck the camera right in front of the herd.
Yeah.
He wanted to hear the thunder, the rumble of them going through town, being rushed through, the whistles, the call-outs from the cowboys. So it was really well done with the difference, and hopefully everybody felt that.
Oh, I mean, I thought going through town, and I loved all the whistles and the authenticity of all of that. I thought it was spectacular. And the fact the camera really was in one place, and it, as they start coming by and coming by, he really stayed away from an extremely wide shot. So it really honed in on the Longhorns, stampeding down, and then slowly bringing the camera back out so that you could see some, you know, cow patties dropped in the street and things like that. And a very frightened Sebastian on the sidewalk.
Yeah.
With location number two, that was absolutely magical and exquisite. I love how the music came up and there's nothing else that we're hearing, because that particular motif is stunning. It is.
Yeah.
It just captures the beauty.
Right. Yeah. The cinematography and the music just were a perfect couple during that shot. I really loved it.
Particularly early in one of the episodes where we have Helen in the kitchen cooking. We even get to hear her with the fork on the cast iron skillet. Those little things I appreciated, because I know what that sounds like, but I think there's an audience today that might not realize what a lot of these sounds are. Do you ever think about that when you and the team are working on the sound design, the sound editing, how so many of these sounds are going to be unknown to much of the audience?
True to what we're seeing, and it's funny how you brought that up, because it's such a little thing and it goes by for so many people, but we stood there, and what I'm trying to do when we have little shots like that is I'm trying to make the sound like there's labor here. This is 1923. There's no microwaves, or you don't just tap a button and something renders for you. So we put the labor into the sound. We want to make sure that they're coming across as nothing is easy right now. You know, whether it's going to the rent or going to the sheds to get your eggs, to cut up the meat, which he did later on the episode or another episode. But that sound is we really did take something thick and hit it across the cast iron, as opposed to just finding any utensil. Like we put the thought into every sound just to sell what life was like, and hopefully that, whether it's subliminal or not, comes across to the audience, especially for someone younger who, you know, may have not really thought about stuff like that until they see a show like this. So I'm glad you noticed that, because we really do meticulously look at it like, okay, she's going up these stairs, she's holding something, we gotta have the stairs creak, we gotta make the floor sound, you know, like there's labor. I keep food, or you know, the snowstorm, trying to stay warm, trying to, you know. So yeah, that's, you know, we're trying to again match the image with the sound, as opposed to just putting, you know, a basic library sound. We really try to stay authentic, I guess.
And you do this in the train once Alexandra has to work for her supper, so to speak. And we see them serving. We hear the clink of dishes, washing the dishes, pouring the tea, things like that. We hear all of those little nuances. We hear the china cups, because nobody uses china cups anymore, or some people do, but it's a rarity. So we actually hear those sounds, and you get the idea of the labor, but you also, especially with the train sequences and Alexandra's approach to pouring and serving, it also shows us a different demographic and upbringing, so to speak. Not used to labor and treating something gingerly. So I like what the sound created in those sequences with Alexandra working as a waitress on the train. Really nicely done, yeah. George.
Thank you very much. I remember that scene, and we purposely separated the labor sounds from the kitchen and her colleagues working. And what we did to counter that is we recorded some in loop group. We recorded the voices of the passengers having a good time, laughing, and we even threw in some British accents just to make it like high society, high class, just to counter what Alexandra was going through. So hopefully that came across, because we kept her and her colleagues and the kitchen staff. We didn't put a single word, record a single word of dialogue for any of them. We just had them work, the dishes, the water, and everything. And then the only voices were from the passengers, completely disregarding the labor that they're going through by having them having a good old time and waiting to be served on and everything. So I'm glad you brought that up, because I really enjoy when one group of sounds counter the other to sort of help tell the story of, look what happened to her working for her food. She's starving, and these people are traveling first class. And, you know, so that's always fun when it's two opposite sides in the same scene. I love that.
It's so effective. So effective. Now, I can't wait to see the next two episodes. But in order to satisfy my passion for your work and for Mosa, I have also now watched the studio the first two episodes.
Oh, good.
George!
I hope you like it. I hope you like it.
Okay, the studio, it is simply delicious. It is hilarious. There's so much truth in this, but it is hilarious. And the sound is incredible. The mix with the needle drops and the score that really harkens to, you know, the comedies of the 30s, the 40s. Even the 50s, just with those two episodes. The sound editing is wonderful. We've got exteriors. We're driving in convertibles. We're racing through the canyon. Here again, this is another show where there is some great camera work there, such as Seth Rogen he's driving up the driveway, the curvy driveway he shouldn't be driving up after driving through the streets in the hills. And you hear, yes, he's driving, and he's driving faster than he should, because you can hear wind created by the speed of the car. And it's the little things again, George, that already are standing out for me with the studio. Is your approach to something like the studio different than to how you approach 1923 or 1883?
In this case, with the studio, it was so different. Honestly, I can't remember the last time I had such a difference in approach. And thank you again for all the kind words. I'm glad you like it. Yeah, the studio was the first show for me where it was a one-shot. Every scene is filmed as a one-shot. All scenes and all episodes throughout the season, actually, are all one-shot. So what that does for us, for sound, is it's a cat-and-mouse game. Basically, the camera's moving, and the sound has to chase the camera because it's not one angle to the next.
Right.
So I, in terms of panning sounds, like the footsteps for this character going here, then there, now the camera's moving, now we have to move the perspective of the ambiance. And, you know, we had to stay subtle because we didn't want to throw the audience off trying to keep up with so much sound moving. But the approach, mostly on the mix stage, and, you know, the mixers, I'll have to give them credit. They really had to focus of when is too much and when is too little because of the one-shot filming style. You know, 1917, the movie, is obviously a perfect example of that whole film. But this being a comedy, we have to be careful, too. We, mm-hmm. you know, comedy is dialogue, timing, and, you know, this is what's going to make the audience laugh. So we couldn't be intrusive with sound too much. So only when the opportunity came up, we took advantage of the one-shot filming style. And I'm glad you liked the music, too, because it's such a character in the show.
Yeah.
I love the way it brings you into the scene or takes you out of the scene, depending what's happening. And I know only the first two episodes are out yet, but yeah, Antonio Sanchez, the composer, you know, everybody loves his music, and his team, Lorena Batista, is the music editor. They did such a great job in just playing a supporting role to the comedy. So I'm glad you brought that up. But yeah, the approach was almost like, you know, I had to, okay, let me just go to sleep for a few days, get rid of 1923. Now let me start studio and, you know, take a different approach here.
Totally different. I have to say, as soon as episode one starts and I'm watching it and we open to the a windblown snowstorm scene, a death scene as well. It's just, as soon as they yell cut, because it's a film within a film, and the camera starts to move, and I'm going, son of a bitch. It's Warner Brothers. That's the back lot. I was just there a few months ago on the back lot at that pool area that is normally doesn't have water or anything in it.
Right.
It's normally empty until they need it for something. And that whole little drive on the golf cart that Seth Rogen takes, it's like, yep, been there, done that. So that really made me chuckle. And then pulling up in front of some of the buildings, then the minute you walk in, here again, the floor surface. That had to be a challenge for you, matching all those footsteps on the floor surfaces there. It's a very distinctive floor surface, and the echo in the building. It echoes.
Yeah, definitely. That's building 140. I spent many years there, and it was a relief, too, actually, when I finally saw the first episode, and I recognized the law just like you did. So it was, you know, my ears were used to it because I did Gotham in that building for 5 years. So every morning I walked through that building. and actually, you know, even that area from the golf cart drive, and you'll see more as the season progresses, but that was sort of a relief having spent many years on that lot to get a show that actually filmed on that lot. And I was able to sneak on there one day actually with a microphone and just, you know, take a golf cart, drive around, walk through buildings, and had to do that very early in the morning before it got busy. But
sure.
That was fortunate for sure when that came up. So, but I'm glad you had a chuckle when you saw, you know, familiar.
Oh my, yeah.
Part of.
Because decades, when I was doing film production for quite a few years, I was on the Warner lot. I was over at CBS Radford. I was at Universal. I was at Universal a lot. Just absolutely, for me, it just thrilled me to no end to see and hear that, because that is what it sounds like. And that's always a testament, as far as I'm concerned, when sounds that I'm familiar with from specific locations. And yes, that is the sound I'm hearing. And all of your work, no matter what you're working on, and actually any of the guys at Formosa, do such an amazing job with that, with the authenticity factor.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm nervous about the studio because, like, this is a show about our business. I'm like, okay, I got to know how everything sounds.
Well,
because, you know, I've lived this every day.
The first two episodes, they sound fabulous. They look fabulous. I laughed myself silly. The studio, it is, quite honestly, it is delicious. That's the word for it. It is delicious. It reminds you of the Hollywood that once was, primarily thanks to a lot of the needle drops and the score. Also, Bryan Cranston's Bob Evans-esque character. Every time he's on screen, I'm sorry, I can't help but laugh. And how Seth Rogen can stand there with a straight face or sit there opposite him with a straight face is just beyond me.
Yeah, it's really well written, too. They do reference old Hollywood.
A lot.
As you'll see, you know, if you continue to watch. So you're nailing it, though. It really is an homage to old Hollywood versus new Hollywood and, you know, so on and so forth throughout the season.
And you get Catherine Hahn in there, who's just totally off the wall. And when she slams things down, or she shoves everything off the desk, and we hear everything clattering to the floor. I am just so thrilled with the studio so far. I cannot wait to see the rest of it. Just like I cannot wait to see the last two episodes of 1923, which I know Taylor has said there will not be a season three.
That's news to me then. Thank you for that.
I heard that's what he said, that this is the end.
I won't say too much. Although I will say episode 7 is actually a 2-hour finale, so hope you enjoy that.
Ooh! Well, that makes me even happier.
Ben shot it to be a 2-hour finale, so.
Wow.
But yeah, story-wise, I can see why Taylor said this is the end. It's, makes sense, I guess, but I think originally it was supposed to be the second of an anthology, but I guess, you know, things changed between 1883 and the season one of 1923, so, but, you know, it's great. Great actors and great stories. So.
And, of course, then
there was
the rumor of 1944, but since then, now there's allegedly at some point he's going to be writing the Beth and Rip continuation of Yellowstone.
Yep.
There's only so many hours in the day to write and create. If no one told him.
Yeah.
There's only so many hours.
Workhorse.
But I got one last question for you, George. This is so much fun talking with you. But I've got one last question for you. I've got to know, you've been at this for quite a while. What is the gift? What is the gift that your sound work gives to you that makes you keep wanting to do it and doing it so damn well?
To tell you the truth, it's the people around me. There's so many people that I'm thankful for when I first moved to L.A., you know, almost 30 years ago, actually more than 30 years ago at this point. It's almost like they're so good, I want to be as good as them. And, you know, there's never an end in this work, you know what I mean? Something can always be different or better depending what word you want to use. You know, everything, there's so much good sound out there. But there's always a way, like, let's do this different. Make it sound more unique or a different kind of sound type of thing. I hate using the word, you know, better or improving, stuff like that, because again, there's just everyone around me. I'm lucky too to be part of a network where everybody's just striving for more, so it's just, you know, it becomes a heroine to people like myself and people I work with, you know what I mean? You gotta have more, you want more, and you know, look, we're part of the side of the industry. You know, we're not making tens of millions of dollars or anything like that. You know what I mean? We're living comfortably. Obviously, we're not starving or anything like that. But it's still like we, you know, all that aside, it's just look what we're doing. Look how lucky we are. So let's not screw up. Let's not take anything for granted or take advantage of anyone like that. Let's do more as opposed to let's just keep everything the same. You know, if it's not broken, don't fix it. Like, no, let's try to do better. Let's try to do more. Let's try to give back more. You know, let's add more to the storytellers that are bringing, you know, their shows to us and trusting us. So that's the approach I take. And, you know, I feel comfortable doing that.
But, you know, now you said a key word, so I do have to follow up with one thing. What is the most unique sound that you have in season 2 of 1923?
I would say it would be the snowstorm, because we didn't want to just blast the audience with, you know, strong winds and stuff like that. It's, you know, growing up in a winter city myself, going through those storms, there's something characteristic about a snowstorm, wind, and any other sounds you hear around you, depending what environment you are. But that scene alone, with horses and children in the scene, and the danger that the actors were, performing with one of them about to die, that to me was the most unique scene for sounds. I know it was multiple sounds and everything, but I was really happy. Well, big sound. So those winds were carefully crafted, carefully mixed, depending where we were in the scene. Let's bring it up here. Let's bring it back down here. Let's bring in some snow debris now. Now let's focus on the horses. They're not, you know what I mean? So it really was mapped out meticulously. So I was really happy with the way that turned out. And hopefully that came across and everybody understood the dialogue in the scene. And it played a good role, I thought.
It really did. I have to agree. George, this has been an absolute blast getting to speak with you. I keep telling everybody, I'm going to make my way through everybody at Formosa one day. Sooner or later.
Well, you know, you have a great reputation, Debbie. And like I said, I've always heard about your energy and your excitement. And, you know, we really appreciate what you do. And this really is a bucket list check off for me.
Oh,
so thank you.
Thank
so
you.
For doing this.
And hopefully we're going to get to chat again in the future.
Please, I'm begging you. Please do. I'm here anytime. And I would really love to see that photo, actually, of the coil cables covered in cloth and everything. If you can. I mean, don't kill yourself over here.
I want to go down the rabbit hole through photographs, okay? So, you know, over the coming weeks, I'm going to take some time and go down a rabbit hole out of pure enjoyment. Rather than necessity. So.
Yeah, take your time. No rush, but it would be exciting to see.
I will do my due diligence and I will find it for you, George.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
George, you go have a wonderful, wonderful rest of your day. And yes, we will chat sooner rather than later again.
Excellent. Thanks so much. You do the same. And anytime you need anything, let me know.
I will. Thanks, George. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Debbie. Bye-bye.